Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, welcome to another Brahalastapa Book Club. I'm delighted that this week we have the book Killing Thatcher by Rory Carroll, which I'm going to tell you, I read last year. It was my book of 2023. I read a lot of books in 2023. This is my favourite book of 2023, and it's about to come out in paperback. And I'm joined by Rory now. Hello, Rory.
Hey, Richard. Thank you for having me, and thanks for, I mean, that really is an honour, by the way. I mean, to get your number one slot,
good. No, well, it's such a great book because it's a history book about recent history. It's about, obviously, the Brighton bombing, but it reads like a thriller, and it's so impressive, the amount, which we'll talk about later, but the amount of investigative journalism that must have gone into this, I think, could be another book. I think someone should write a book about you writing this book, because I imagine what went on behind the scenes for you to be able to find out the things you found out must be quite a story in itself.
Yeah, well, it was a wonderful mix of journalism and history. I mean, it hit that sweet spot, because I am by trade a journalist, not a professional historian, but I've always loved history. And because, you know, these events, really, in the sense, the story starts in, you know, the early 1970s, and then it goes up into the mid-1980s. So a lot of the protagonists are still alive. Yeah. Norman Tebbit, for example, and a lot of the police detectives and some of the IRA guys. Many, of course, of the people, core key characters like Margaret Thatcher, are no longer with us. But there were enough people still alive to be able to, you know, use my journalistic skills rather than the, you know, the historian side to, you know, to kind of ferret out facts and color and details. And so I just loved that mix, you know, of the two.
Yeah, and obviously it's a huge story, and I guess having like this period of time away from it, it would have been a contentious book to write, you know, probably even 10-15 years ago, but it feels like enough time has passed that you can give I'd say it's a balanced account. So it's you know, you're not making moral judgments on people. You're explaining motivations without necessarily condoning the terrorist activities. But it's it's difficult to say this in the right way. It's not sympathetic to the terrorists, but you explain their motivations, whether that's justified or not, and what caused at least them to want to have this campaign of violence, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I have, of course, my own moral compass, prejudices like anyone else. But in this book, I was really doing my best to, in a sense, almost approach it as a novel in that, you know, pick a handful of characters. I say characters, I mean, these were real people. I mean, sure. Margaret Thatcher was one, Patrick McGee, the IRA bomber was another, Gerry Adams, and some of the police detectives. But, you know, so I pick a handful of people and then we enter in their worlds and their minds, and we kind of see, you know, who they were as individuals, as human beings, where they're coming from, what matters to them, what they're aiming at, where their part of the story fits in. And I really wanted the reader to kind of to feel they understood them, not that they had to be cheering for them. You know, if you're kind of appalled by the IRA, by what the IRA did, it's not that you're going to come out cheering for the IRA, but that when you are reading the parts about Patrick McGee, you see where he's coming from. You go, okay, so you can understand why he did what he did. And likewise, if you're appalled by Margaret Thatcher, if you're a good guardianista and you think she wrecked Britain, well, in this book, you're going to enter her own world as well. And you're going to be not necessarily come out of it thinking, I love Margaret Thatcher, but that you will, I hope, have a better understanding of what made her tick and how she fit into the story and why she did what she did.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, that most surprisingly, I came out feeling sympathy for Margaret Thatcher and seeing her as a human being, which I wasn't necessarily anticipating. But again, not with condoning necessarily her own viewpoints and her own decisions. But yeah, it is fascinating from that point of view. And like you, I that's one of my childhood memories. 1984, I must have been sort of 15, 16 maybe when it happened. And it was because it was on breakfast news. It was breakfast news had more or less just started, I guess, at that time. And so all those pictures of Norman Tebbit emerging from the dust, I feel we all were watching live that morning.
Yes. And I mean, just for people who have not read the book, I mean, to set the scene a bit, I mean, the story of the book is that the IRA decided to go try to assassinate Margaret Thatcher. And this was a plot that took years in the making. And they're chosen after scouting Tory party conferences for several years and picking a team to do this. They decided to do so at the Brighton party conference in October 1984. It was the last night of the conference. Thatcher is in the Grand Hotel, a big old kind of nine-story Victorian seafront hotel. And, you know, they had set a time bomb 3 weeks earlier. And, you know, the whole story behind that is kind of the core of the book about how they did it and why they did it. But as you said, once the bomb detonated and the way it was so, in a sense, kind of fiendishly constructed, that it wasn't the bomb itself in a sense that was the weapon. It's the way the bomb, and they sent over the IRA structural engineer to study the architecture of the hotel. And that they, I mean, the bomb exploded on the sixth floor and exploded upwards, tore a hole in the roof, and there toppled a chimney. And this five tons of Victorian masonry then wobbled and then collapsed down like a sort of guillotine, you know, taking out, obliterating room after room after room. And the idea, the hope for the IRA was that this would then entomb Margaret Thatcher. And they came so close to doing so. Now, when we saw, you know, on Breakfast TV, then captured the aftermath, and we see, I mean, in live, and this was like way before, you know, live TV, the internet, and we're suddenly seeing in the pictures of rubble and dust and fire crews and police trying to find out what's happened and trying to dig out survivors, finding bodies, and famously, Norman Tebbit, Margaret Thatcher's lieutenant and kind of the heir apparent to Thatcherism, being dragged out, kind of bloodied in his pyjamas from the rubble. And that became, you know, one of the iconic images from the whole story.
Yeah. And, you know, it is, I guess this, you know, the book is fascinating in working, you know, you've managed, because Patrick McGee has written a book, an autobiography, which he does not discuss the bombing at all, really? Is that right? Or how the bombing worked at all?
Well, what kind of, in a sense, got me started on this book was the fact that Patrick McGee, who was a Belfast-born IRA member, and he was the guy who planted the bomb, who went and his, without giving necessarily the whole backstory of Patrick McGee, but in terms of like the IRA, you know, they were the guys who operated in England were sort of their commandos. They were, in a sense, the operational elite, because that was the most tricky thing to do, because you were out of the IRA hinterland of Northern Ireland, you're behind enemy lines, and you need to, you know, to kind of to blend in. And he had grown up actually for a while, several years in of his boyhood in Norwich, and he could do an English accent, which was of huge value, because you can imagine in the mid 80s, you know, someone with a West Belfast Gerry Adams accent, you know, checking into a hotel would just, you know, even it would raise an eyebrow, or people might would notice, would clock that, you know.
Yeah.
And so he could put on an English accent. So he was sent over at 3 weeks before the Tory party conference. So before the whole panoply of security and police had arrived, he checked into a room, and he constructed the bomb, planted it, concealed it, and then walked away, disappeared. Yeah. And the bomb is ticking. So, you know, when the bomb, sorry, forgive me, Richard. Now, what was the question? I went off on a tangent.
Well, it was just that he's written a book, but not about the actual campaign.
That's right. So he was subsequently, again, I don't want to give too much away, but I mean, he was eventually he was caught, and he served time. He was released early under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. And he has had a remarkable afterlife since his release from prison. And he put a lot of this down in a book called Where Grieving, you know, I have it, do I have it here beside me? Where Grieving Begins. And it's about his childhood and why he joined the IRA and a bit of about his career in the IRA. But it's very explicit. It says, I am not going to reveal anything of operational details about the bombing. And now I interviewed him about his book for an article in The Guardian. And we did speak then a bit about the Brighton operation, but he didn't, you know, spill any beans to me. And I knew he wouldn't, because he's a very self-contained, very soft-spoken guy. In fact, he's a doctor of literature. He obtained a PhD while he was in prison. So a very bright guy. But in preparing for that interview with him for this Guardian article, I kind of read around the whole Brighton bombing story, of which I assumed was very familiar. I mean, I was 12 years old when the bomb went off. I remember the, you know, Norman Tebbit being dragged out and the shock of it. And I thought, well, it's all quite familiar, right? But once I started reading it, I thought, well, actually, there's a whole bunch of things that had happened here that I'd never heard of before, or if I had, I'd forgotten them. And, you know, then trying to kind of connect the dots of like the background to it, I mean, I started to see that there was a largely untold story here. And then going back to your original question about history and journalism, that there was a fantastic opportunity now to tell it, because enough of the people involved in it were still alive, still with us. And as you said, now a bit more willing to talk about things, because enough time has passed, people are a bit more, you know, reflective, and they feel they can now safely discuss these things.
Yeah. And you say in the book that there are some conflicting accounts, and you've chosen the ones that you think are the most feasible or most likely. So that you've had to make some choices on who you believe, I suppose, with some of the stories.
Yes, there are certain lots of things actually of which are very contested. Some things quite, you know, quite trivial in a way, other things quite central. And I chose, my method was, you know, to do as much reporting as I could to come up with what I think is the most plausible, credible version, and just go with that in the narrative. But in there are notes, end notes, which are very copious at the back of the book, where all the sourcing is laid out, and where I explain why, for example, if there's a contested version of something, it's in the notes saying, you know, so I know most readers don't go there, but those who do, you know, who really want to dive into the weeds of it, will find the other alternative versions there.
Yeah. And I think, again, as someone in the UK, and I'm someone who has been interested in the Irish question and studied the sort of 19th century version of it and the early 20th century version of it at school and university, you know, I think in the UK, we're not very knowledgeable about Ireland and why this situation exists. And I think this book does a very good job as well of just summing up the situation and explaining, you know, each of the major points, right up to the hunger strikes and everything as well, before the bombing, about why that was happening, what it meant. And, you know, I suppose what was there's interesting things such as the fact that the sort of brutality of the occupying forces against McGee is one of the things that supposedly made him kind of committed to the cause. He wasn't very interested in it, but then he got beaten up and imprisoned for nothing, and that sort of brewing resentment. So the kind of aggression of the British forces didn't help the situation, unsurprisingly. But you know, I think it's interesting how little we know about it, and I think how much we've been shielded, I suppose, because, you know, again, in the 80s, we had all that ridiculous stuff of Gerry Adams being voiced by an actor and all that sort of stuff, and it was all and everyone had to believe everyone in the UK had to believe the UK version of these events and not think about it too much. But I think the book was very strong on that, and how interesting it is that Ireland is this sort of inconvenience, really, to the politicians, that they'd rather be concentrating on something else, but they've got this problem that they can't solve. Because they haven't studied it properly.
No, well, absolutely. I mean, Ireland, Northern Ireland, for a lot of British people, in fact, even Northern Ireland for a lot of Irish people in the South, you know, during the Troubles, it was dreary, depressing, boring, complicated. And, you know, at some point, people just turned off, you know, even as the bombs and Troubles continued. But it is so bleak and it's so intractable. You know, people just kind of got fed up, and it disappeared from the front pages from most occasions. And so, you know, what I wanted to do in the book was, firstly, I had to still pack in a lot of history to explain things. And, you know, I tried to do that as kind of economically and as clearly as possible. And also, again, through the perspectives of characters, so that, you know, the reader doesn't necessarily realize, I hope, that they're getting history lessons, you know, that what they're learning about and being invested in is certain characters. And you kind of, even if you don't necessarily like a character, but you want to know what happens to them. Yeah. And, you know, and that way you can kind of see in the backstory of the history. So you kind of, the history kind of, in a sense, smuggled in, because I felt, you know, I had to earn the reader's attention. You know, you can't assume, you know, I remember I mentioned this when I first mentioned to my mum, actually, that I was going to do a book on the Brighton bombing. And she gave me this look and said, but, you know, but Thatcher survived, end off, you know, who cares? And she had a point. Because we all kind of, in a sense, know the ending. But just like in The Day of the Jackal, I mean, we know that Frederick Forsyth novel, we know the Jackal fails, right? We know de Gaulle survives. And yet it's kind of the process, the method, the manhunt. And that's how the tension and suspense is. So my hope, my goal was to, you know, to do the same, which is that, you know, the reader will feel kind of carried along on the story. And they know, in a sense, the denouement, but the journey of how we get there is fascinating, and so that was the goal.
Yeah, well, you absolutely achieved that. I think it's, you know, I think because the way you do it by going through characters. I mean, starting with Mountbatten, the Mountbatten thing is, it really brings through the horror of being caught up in an attack like that, and you know, the fact he was sort of slightly sympathetic to the Irish question as well, but also obviously all the other people who were killed and injured in all of these explosions, which I think it's great within the book that you do name. It's not just like three people died. You will say when bystanders are killed, you name them, which I think is very important, because it shows respect for that, shows sort of that these aren't just figures, these are real people. But I think, you know, there is there's a thriller excitement to both the terrorists coming up with the ideas, which is a little bit like, I suppose, a version of the World War II escape committees, you know, that came up with these amazing plans to, which I'm always fascinated, to escape Colditz and wherever, and that you've got to come up with these plans. So that's very interesting, whilst dodging being caught, but also the people, the police chasing him, the guys who tried to disarm the bombs. And again, there's a very moving story about the a bomb disposal guy being killed in the Wimpy bombings in London.
Yes, I mean, there's all these elements, like, you know, subplots within it where, for example, there's Peter Gurney, this very brave, courageous army and then police bomb disposal guy. And his life and career kind of threaded that of Patrick McGee, you know, and in a sense, because, you know, IRA bombers, as they got more sophisticated, were then setting booby traps aimed specifically to try to blow up the bomb disposal guys. Yeah. So there's this kind of battle war within the war. And that's part of this. And, you know, I find that fascinating. And it's such a, like, you know, you kind of have to fettle that in. And likewise, I mean, one for me, I really was struck by just kind of little elements of class. Like, for example, like a lot of the police, you know, and I spoke to, I was struck by how many of the detectives and also David Tadd, who's the fingerprint expert in Scotland Yard. A lot of these guys were working class boys, were very bright, but hadn't gone to university. So they end up in the police force in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, the really bright ones kind of, it seemed quite meritocratic, you know, and they were very, really interesting. Just, you know, talking to them and how they were then battling these other kind of working class guys from basically the IRA guys who were also from working class. But then I remember one thing that struck to me was in the rubble of the Brighton bombing, when you'd firemen trying to dig people out. There was Sarah Berry, a lady, Sarah Berry. She was the wife of a Tory MP who, you know, very tragically died there. But as the police were trying to extract her, or the firemen trying to dig her out, they couldn't see her, but they could hear her. And, you know, it's quite important for them to get a connection with a person. They want to keep them talking, keep them alive. And they said, "So who's there? What's your name?" And she said, the response that came out through this wall of brick and dust was Lady Sarah. And the fireman heard that. It's like, lady? I mean, like, he's trying to build up a rapport. Yeah. And now he's got, like, to use an aristocratic title. I mean, the world has literally fallen, collapsed in on these people. And yet the British class system, you know, still somehow is survives and endures right in that moment. And, you know, and just that what was going through the fireman's mind is like, do I use the title? Yes or no? I mean, it's only one line in the book, if even half a line. But, you know, as those kind of humanizing details for me were just, a very rewarding way to kind of, you know, rewind of history.
No, really, that was really what struck me as well. I was trying to remember some of them, but that's a really good one. But there are lots of lovely little details that ground the time, the place and the people. And it really is. And there's humour obviously in this as well. Sometimes it's dark humour, but obviously if you're working in this environment, jokes are often the only way to process and get through when you're sort of digging your way through, you know, people blown apart and still alive but disfigured. I think you have to maintain a sense of humor, but obviously things go wrong, and so there's comedy in everything. So there is a little bit of comedy, surprisingly, in this book. Which,
yes, I mean, there was Harvey Thomas. He was I loved him as a character, and he sadly died quite recently. He had been the Tory party guy responsible for the conference, for running it and setting it up. And I mean, he was had a terrible ordeal. I mean, he was on the seventh floor just above the bomb. And, you know, he was kind of blown out of his bed and then trapped under all this kind of rubble on this perilous ledge. And meantime, there's water pipe almost stuck. He can't move. He's completely kind of paralyzed, pinned down by all this weight. And then he had like a water pipe, you know, was burst and he was at risk of drowning. Meantime, then there's electric cables kind of sparking around. Maybe he's going to get electrocuted. I mean, there's about 100 different ways he was going to die there. The rescuers very bravely reached him. And, you know, and it took them several hours to get him out. And he's just firing these zinger one-liners off them of pure kind of, I don't know, kind of Seinfeldian kind of jokes whilst trapped in the circumstance. And, you know, I mean, that was just remarkable. And asked him about it, and he you know, and he's very kind of like, well, you know, kind of the, you know, the Blitz generation, you know, we're just get on with things. And, and it was kind of refreshing, you know, to hear that. So, whenever there was a chance for glints of humor, in the book, I just kind of grabbed onto that, because as long as it was relevant and, you know, appropriate, like to put that in, because, that's what humans, that's what we do. I mean, often we make jokes about the most awful things.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And it's a sort of surreal world, because obviously, like, some being involved in an explosion, or being involved in killing people, or being involved in protecting people, or your job being to defuse bombs, that's not, you know, you're not operating in a real world, in a sense. You're operating in this bizarre world where strange things happen. So I think just things like Thatcher insisting the conference went ahead and everyone having to go to Marks and Spencer's having to open early so they could all buy some clothes to go to the conference. That must have been such a surreal moment for all these, you know, these stunned people to be walking through.
Another era. And in a sense, you know, the Brighton bombing helped to kind of cement the legend of the Iron Lady, because the way she responded to it. I mean, she, in the immediate aftermath of the bombing, she was, once they managed the police to get out of the hotel, they took her to Brighton Police Station as a temporary, which became a kind of the temporary Downing Street, you know, the kind of government of all these kind of dusty survivors from, you know, government ministers and some in their pajamas or in their slippers arriving at this police station at, you know, 3:30 in the morning. And Thatcher there, very imperial, very calm. I mean, Dennis Thatcher, meantime, he apparently kind of freaked out and he was shouting in the car, those fucking bastards, the IRA, whereas Thatcher was just very controlled. But, you know, in this chaotic scene, but at the police station where her security people and the police are trying to figure out how are we going to get it back to Downing Street as fast as possible. And she raps the table and says, gentlemen, just to let you know, I'm not leaving. You know, the conference will go on as usual. And there was silence in the room as her aides, Downing Street officials and police chiefs are looking at her in horror, thinking, but, you know, we're still digging people out. I mean, the Brighton Promenade it looks like a war zone, and the conference center is right beside it. And she's saying it's going to go on as usual, in a few hours, and like in 2-3 hours? You know, and they were like, oh, God, no. They just wanted to get her out of there and seal off the whole place. But she insisted, because for her, it wasn't enough that she had survived in terms of defying the IRA. The conference was going to go ahead. So to show the IRA that it even failed to kill her and failed to even disrupt the conference. Yeah. And so sure enough, the conference goes ahead, partly by ferrying all these Tories in their pajamas to Marks and Spencer's, which opened especially early that morning, so they could get clothes and shoes and then be ferried straight back to the conference center. And sure enough, the conference went ahead at 9 a.m. that morning, whilst just adjacent to it, firemen and police are looking for corpses, looking for survivors. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely an extraordinary moment for the UK.
Yeah, which again sort of cemented a cemented a reputation. There's so many fascinating things about it. I mean, and about the nature of protest and what's the best way to make a point. And obviously, violence begets violence, as we're seeing in the world constantly, but especially now, I suppose. And that cycle of violence has to be broken. But equally, without the violence, it probably wouldn't be an issue. If it was just the hunger strikers wouldn't have been in prison maybe without having there been some violence anyway. But that kind of sort of peaceful protest of killing yourself in order to make a point is one way of going. But without the violence, would Ireland even have been on the agenda? So it's sort of a confusing to try and work out how you solve these problems. It's sort of amazing we got to the point where we had the Good Friday Agreement and things seemed to be, and hopefully still will be sortable. But
there's the counterfactual as well of the great, what would have happened had she died, and which is completely unanswerable, really. But I mean, the fact that firstly is that they came so close, and they really did. I mean, I said history pirouetted on geometry, really, because I mean that this kind of concrete avalanche that fell, that came down through the hotel, obliterating one room after another, it actually took a swerve. At one point, it would have gone directly down into Margaret Thatcher's suite. She was in the Napoleon suite on the first floor. And for various reasons, the avalanche shifted and took out all the rooms on the adjacent side.
Yeah.
Now, had she died, what would have happened? How would history, Britain and the world be today? Well, different for sure. So it looks like, possibly we'd have Norman Tebbit as a prime minister. Despite his grievous injuries, he could have then been succeeded her. But also she at that point became a crucial bridge between this new interesting Soviet leader called Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan's White House. And she, in a sense, kind of introduced them, and she emboldened Ronald Reagan to détente after the Brighton bombing. So, I mean, there's so many things that could have changed in an instant with that bombing. And I mean, I don't go too much into that in the book because, as I said, it's unanswerable, but it's certainly fascinating.
It is fascinating. And how did they get? Was it just luck that McGee got the right room? How did he? I know he asked for a room with a sea view, but how did he know he was going to get he obviously need the room sort of above the crucial areas, right? Or was that just?
Because they had cased out Brighton, so they anticipated correctly that Thatcher would be in the Napoleon suite, so facing the seafront. And the IRA had come up with a sort of matrix of rooms where, we're going to put the bomb, which rooms would work, in terms of what would do the damage that we wanted to do. And so they had a certain matrix of rooms. And when he checked in, Patrick McGee, into the hotel, he requested a sea-facing room. He didn't add more detail than that and see what were they going to offer him. And the one they did was on the sixth floor and was kind of within that matrix of acceptability for the IRA. So he's like, okay, thanks, I'll take that.
Okay.
And, because for them, they were thinking, okay, six floors up, it's sufficiently far up from Margaret Thatcher's suite that the police probably not going to check it that thoroughly. And in fact, the police didn't check it at all. So the bomb, in a sense, will kind of be safe. But we think, especially because it's an upward exploding device, as I mentioned earlier, you kind of take out the roof and then the chimney can come down. And then once the chimney comes down, it'll go right down into the basement and taking out each room. So, that's why they had it kind of, it's a roll of the dice. They couldn't know if it was going to kill her or not, but they could only, plant the bomb, cross their fingers.
Yeah. And I like, there's again, one of the funny details is that three doors down from him, someone was taking erotic photos of their partner, I think. Was it you mentioned it a couple of times, but you don't say how you know that, but presumably the police interviewed them.
It wasn't the police. It was, and I remember I wondered, should I put this in? I mean, I was talking to, when I was in Brighton, and also doing lots of it over the phone, because a lot of this, the research coincided with lockdowns. But I ended up speaking to this woman whose father had been a photographer. She had, she used to go with him to the Grand Hotel. And she mentioned that he had, on the day of in which Patrick McGee, or during that weekend that he was planting the bomb, her dad had been there doing his usual thing, looking for people to take portraits of. And he was asked by one of the guests to come up into this room because to take erotic portraits of whom, you know, of his partner, who may or may not have been a prostitute. And, you know, the guy, the photographer, kind of did so. And then he shared this with the daughter and the wife and became entered family lore, you know. Right. And then it just happened that they'd realized later on that this had been the same weekend that the bomb was being planted. So it was just kind of family, local family legend. Yeah. And I just kind of fell across that. So I remember in the storytelling side, I was thinking, well, I mean, that's kind of funny. Is it? Would you include it? I mean, it's kind of there's a bit of a so what factor, but yeah, not use it. I mean, you know, it's just again, I think it's just one line or two lines in the story. But again, you wanted to bring this back to life so people can, you know, I was trying to conceive certain chunks of the book in scenes, you know, almost cinematic in a way that you could actually visualize what's happening. For example, in this hotel. So while Patrick McGee is in his room, you know, planting this device, you have life goes on around him, you know, in this hotel, and yeah, down the corridor there's X and Y going on, and you know, because that's, yeah, again, that's what humans do, you know. Yeah. So that was the goal, to make it vivid and real, but also completely or accurate. You know, I mean, this is a work of journalism.
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, what is, you know, it's one of those books that once you get into it, I was listening to it, but, you know, you don't want to put it down, or you don't want to turn it off, because you want to find out what happens next, even though, you know to an extent what happens next, but you don't know all the details of it. But it is gripping. It does read like a thriller. And the fact it's real, you know, it's you really, I think it's so beautifully judged, because I think you do appreciate it's not like a thriller in the sense, in the thriller when a peripheral character dies, you go, oh well, a peripheral character dies, and you go, oh shit, that was, you know, that's a real person, this is a terrible thing. You make that very clear. But I think it's, you know, it's such, on both sides, on all sides of this, it's such an intriguing story. And I yeah, at the center of it, this sort of cat and mouse between the police and the terrorists, and it's those figures who aren't the well-known figures, aside possibly from the bombers, but it's those figures, as you say, those working class regular guys who managed to track down who's done this, which is an incredible detective job, and then a very thrilling story.
One of my favorite parts in the research and then in the writing was the part with David Tadd, who was the Scotland Yard fingerprint guy, and he, you know, he's very patient with me describing the process of fingerprints, which, again, without giving too much away, but there's a key twist to the whole plot, is that Patrick McGee, and part of kind of IRA fieldcraft at that time, was that when you're checking into a hotel under a pseudonym, you don't want to touch the registration card. You want to sign it without leaving any prints, and then return it to the hotel clerk, you know, without rising suspicion. So you don't be wearing gloves and so on. Anyway, fingerprints become a crucial part of it. And, you know, the process of then identifying the prints, I mean, this was basically the analog era.
Yeah.
So there's no real computers. And the way the process in which Scotland Yard had to go through fingerprints was fascinating and eye-opening to me, of how they were basically just using pen and paper a lot of the time. And, you know, it took them months to get to this fingerprint. So kind of in a sense that the narrative builds up to this is a key pivotal moment. And, you know, to make the reader feel it, I was tormenting David Tadd with questions like, well, when you're in that particular room, what was the lighting like? You know, was there like very bright, or was it dim? And were the floors like squeaky, you know, like were they, or was it carpets, or were people drinking coffee, you know, and what did it smell like? It's all this stuff to kind of like to get, you know, to kind of sensory things, so to kind of bring the reader into it. And, you know, often, you know, you get all this material and then you end up having to kind of only use maybe 5%, you know, that's an agonizing process in the writing. But you know, you kind of get as much as you can. So I can kind of sense, almost feel that I'm in the room myself, and then kind of write it with, you know, a sense of conviction and authority. Like, this is how it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you want the reader to, you know, to bring the reader on that, you know, that journey with you, so they can also just see it with you. And yeah, there are key moments in the book, which is so much fun to write, where you can have the material to do justice to the scenes, you know. And that was why it's so great to have people still alive to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very grateful to all the people, including ex-IRA members, plus ex-police officers who, you know, who gave their time and their trust, more than anything, their trust in speaking to me.
Yeah. And I mean, I was thinking, you know, that it is interesting how difficult that police operation would have been in analog days. But I've, you know, I've been watching that documentary about the Yorkshire Ripper and how badly that case was run and how terrible the police were in that situation and how they basically screwed up everything because of their own prejudices. So it's interesting to see, to read a story about the police, you know, doing an exemplary and fantastic and sort of needle in a haystack job that they succeed with.
Well, except they did and they didn't. I mean, there was major kind of police blunders along the way. I mean, the fingerprint thing was very well done and executed, but there was also misjudgments and blunders by the police and equally by the IRA. So in some ways it was kind of a whole kind of, there was some, you know, kind of extreme intelligence and craftiness on both sides, but also these kind of blunders that you just couldn't believe in retrospect, you know, how they made these mistakes. And again, which is very, very human, you know, yeah. Of these mistakes. And because in the end, you know, when the denouement of, again, I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, this, you know, fast forward like a year on from the bombing, or almost a year, 1985 now, and we have a scene whereby Patrick McGee and an IRA cell are in a tenement house in Glasgow, and Scottish police know that there's IRA people in there. They know Patrick McGee is in there, but they do not know that Patrick McGee is wanted for the Brighton bombing. Now, the anti-terrorist guys in London know this, but it hasn't actually filtered through to the Scottish police, who are the ones on the ground and who, for various reasons, have ending up kind of surrounding this place. But they don't know what the hell's going on. And they need to round up. They decide then to storm this apartment complex without knowing in which apartment the IRA guys are.
Yeah.
So they need to then get weapons, right? But it's Saturday night. There's not enough kind of armed cops in Scotland, you know, at short notice to get guns. So they're having to kind of borrow and improvise like a posse of detectives from, you know, grabbing people from different departments. Have you got a gun? Have you got a gun? You know, and then kind of charging in blind without any pictures or full intel or a map. I mean, you know, so different to the kind of like the SWAT team stuff you see on TV, right?
Yeah.
And it was just so, it's like a rugby team just all kind of grabbing stuff and kind of charging in a way. And you know, so that wasn't especially planned.
No.
You know, I mean, it was like, this was, you know, after the biggest manhunt in British history, like where, you know, a real life Guy Fawkes. Now, I remember, I think Guy Fawkes, to put, you know, the scale of things, I mean, Guy Fawkes, English kids still kind of chant rhymes about Guy Fawkes 500 years after the event of that. And that bomb didn't even go off.
Yeah.
I mean, here we had a bomb that went off, you know, nearly wiped out the government. And biggest manhunt, you know, in one of the biggest manhunts in British history. And yet it ends up being like almost Keystone Cops at the end, except it all works out brilliantly.
You
know?
Yeah.
There was absolutely nothing, you know, preordained about that. In a sense, they, you know, they you had some smart people making good decisions, but also there was luck. And a whole bunch of this, that, you know, the human factor.
Yeah, well, luck is, and this is something I've slightly misquoted throughout my comedy career, but what the IRA said after it failed, which is actually the correct one, is today we are unlucky, but remember, we only have to be lucky once. You have to be lucky all the time, something along those lines. It sums it up brilliantly. It's such a cool thing to say. It's one of the coolest pronouncers by a terrorist ever. So I keep on putting that in scripts because I think it's brilliant. But also the detail in the book that Thatcher was kind of haunted by that and assumed that she would be killed, that she would eventually be assassinated as a result of this.
As propaganda, it was genius, line, that the Lowry threat. I mean, one thing that cropped up in the book to my own research was that Muammar Gaddafi, you know, the Libyan dictator of all people, he very much admired the attack. He thought this was audacious and it kind of restored his faith in the IRA. But he didn't like that line about, you know, we only need to be lucky once. He was offended. He thought this is somehow, you know, diminishing, you know, the importance of the acts and maybe hinting of gambling and something. You know, so he was slightly grumpy about the line, about the attack. Whereas, as you said, Thatcher herself was, wouldn't say haunted, but she had a very human response to the attack, and that she, you know, was actually, despite the public defiance in private, I mean, she was affected by it.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely, as we say, I really want people to read it. I'm sure they will. So let's not talk about it. We'll leave it there without saying anything else. But it's fascinating. And I think that, you know, that view in just the being able to understand everyone's motives and for you to so clearly, you know, make it human and make it emotional, but make it, you know, it's a very exciting read as well, I have to say. So I do thoroughly recommend it. Are you moving on to work on something else beyond this now? Is there another book in the pipeline?
I'd love to. I mean, it's one of the most fulfilling things I've done in my career. So I would love to do another book, especially historical nonfiction, narrative nonfiction. I'd like to do another one. So, but you know, I need to juggle with the, you know, the day job. I'm the Guardian's Ireland correspondent. So, I'd love to. So, I'm looking at some ideas.
Okay. How long did it take you to? It's hard to quantify because obviously you were working as an article, and then, but it must have taken a big chunk of your life.
The research took about a year and a half, and then the writing 6 months.
Right. Okay.
So I took 6 months off unpaid leave from the Guardian just to do the writing, and that was, really intense. But it was strange. I kind of got insomnia for the last 2 months because, you know, you get to each chapter, and I had my notes prepped, and I know what I want to say, but you've all these different strands, like snakes in your head, and you're thinking, how do I kind of tie these all snakes together into a line so it kind of makes sense? And you know, how much color detail to put in, and endless decisions. I mean, just one thing that springs to mind was that I remember when Patrick McGee, the week he was planting the bomb, in the IRA parlance, he was an operator. And it just so happened that Sade's smooth operator was in the charts that week. And I think it topped the charts that week. So I was like, oh, great, I got to use that, right? You know, smooth operator. It was. And then, you know, diving into the lyrics of it and, you know, and then kind of doing that. And but is that too much, you know? And so on. And as it turned out, I think the editor cut the lyrics. And I think and he was right. Yeah. Anyway, these endless decisions in the storytelling of like how much and how little, you know, you don't want to overload it. So. I love the process, but I was also tormented by it as well. So when I was finished writing it, I don't think I'd ever felt so tired in my life.
Yeah. And is the Irish question going to be solved anytime soon in your work as a journalist? Or are you going to be, have you got that job for us?
I think we're sorted, yeah.
No, you've still got a job, right? If you're going to have a job for life there as being Ireland correspondent of The Guardian.
Oh, God. we're just waiting for the Democratic Unionist Party to make a decision about X and Y. The good side, though, and it's easy to forget this, is that, of course, you know, the troubles are over. And I don't think there's any suggestion of Troubles 2.0 coming back. And so Ireland, North and South, are so much better off now than they were before. And so for all of the aggro and dreariness of Northern Ireland politics at the moment, and frustration there about the political deadlock, it's still a hell of a lot better than what we had before.
It sure is, yeah. And it's, you know, but again, it's interesting with that, you know, it's you sort of think, well, violence isn't the answer, because just, you know, that leads to the other side being violent, but ultimately you have to stop the violence. But without the violence, I think, you know, this book makes it quite clear, sort of, that it almost drifted, the IRA had sort of, wasn't that big a deal before the 70s. Again, it sort of drifted away and people weren't that bothered about it. And then the terror sort of brought it all back into focus. So it's a massively complex subject, which one would hope could be solved. But we'll see. But no, thank you for the book. It is fantastic. Is there anything that you're reading yourself or you've read recently you'd like to recommend that's, you know, can be about anything? It doesn't have to be about this issue.
I'm reading David Grann's The Wager at the moment. He's a New Yorker writer, and this book, it's historical narrative nonfiction, and it's fantastic. The Wager, it's about a British Navy ship called The Wager that was chasing a Spanish treasure galleon in the 18th century, and then it was shipwrecked. The Wager was shipwrecked off the coast of Chile, and it's a story of what happened to the survivors. And it's kind of a bit of like The Lord of the Flies and then Robinson Crusoe and Castaways. And then the story of what happened to them on this island, and then how they escaped the island. And then it ends up as a court case back in London, whereby what had happened on the island is then contested, and different factions of the survivors are now on trial for their lives over this. So it's, apart from a fantastic kind of Patrick O'Brien style kind of story, it's the fact that it's true. And then in a sense, it's a look at how we tell our own stories and how we curate our own stories and how, you know, we try to impose our own version on what has happened, which, you know, in that sense, you know, for a story that's centuries old, it actually feels very timely. Yeah. In terms of our era of disinformation, fake news, and you having your own facts. And so, that's my recommendation at the moment. I'm only halfway through it.
That sounds brilliant. I will look that up. That looks fantastic. Look, Rory, thanks so much for giving us some time to talk about the book. I do absolutely recommend it. Second was Adrian Emerson's Berserker, but I haven't had him on the podcast, so you're the best.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I'll take that.
But also, your book was the best. So thank you very much. And thanks to Chris Evans and Ben Evans as well for their hard work behind the scenes.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.